listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont poet Toni Whedon, whose new collection is The Hat Check Girl, published by Green Writers Press in partnership with Sundog Poetry Center. Toni Whedon is a poet, essayist, and musician. Over the past two decades, his writing has appeared in over 100 prominent literary magazines. He is a performing jazz trombonist and leads the Poetry Jazz Ensemble, Poe Jazz, and the Border Band. Toni spends his summers with his wife, Suzanne, at their rural, peaceful cabin in the woods of Vermont. Winter finds them in their bungalow in the Bayou of Georgia, where Toni performs locally and continues his writing and poetry. When I spoke with Toni Whedon, I asked him to begin by talking about his background in music and writing and the relationship between these two art forms for him.
I wouldn't say that they're interchangeable, right, the two art forms, but they're complementary.
Okay.
And, they're survival tools in a way. I mean, because when you get worn out with words, I can go to music, and music says things and brings me to a place that writing can't bring me to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you could say there's a syntax in music and there's a orchestral score to a poem, you know, if not an orchestral score, at least, a musical score to a poem. So they're interconnected. I find that sometimes if I'm playing, I practice a couple hours a day when I'm really at it. And
you play the trombone.
So those, yeah. We played at the Pub and Brewery all summer.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I play around town quite a bit. So, so the music can bring you to a place syntactically, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Syntactically meaning that when you're doing a phrase, you can get an extended phrase in music is almost like a sentence or part of a sentence. There are clauses in music just the way they are. Similar passages in poetry. So, they really help a lot in that way. So, I mean, historically, I started playing the trombone when I was a kid, biographically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was really more excited about that than was about anything in my life. And I started playing when I was quite young, and then played gigs throughout my teenage years with jazz groups in the New York area.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started, of course, at that time, the late 50s, everybody was into the kind of the amalgam of jazz and poetry. Remember, all those beatniks beating on bongos and playing jazz and reciting stuff.
Right.
So, that kind of like, there was a connection, and it just seemed natural to us and a lot of people at that time. And then I think that the two parted ways for me. And I really dropped music because of a number of reasons. I got interested in writing poems and fiction, and I was on my way as a writer. And then back in the early 90s?
Yeah.
It was the early thousands. I got together with some guys at Johnson. We put together a group called Poe Jazz. I don't know if you remember hearing about it
on
the radio.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I saw you guys perform at Vermont College once or twice, I think.
Oh, yeah, we're still doing it. Yeah, we did the postgraduate stuff and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the connection between music and jazz, and so that kind of cemented the connection a lot, too, you know?
Yeah.
So music, and then I didn't write about music until recently. I didn't start writing about music until maybe like 2 or 3 years ago. And so the great majority of the poems in this book are from, maybe 3 or 4 years ago at the most. And then, of course, I got some old ones that I liked and I've kind of rebirthed, and played around with and threw that in there. So that's what happened. Then, of course, I living down here and I got involved in visual stuff and did some watercolors and then threw them into the book.
Yeah.
I didn't think that would work. I just gave them to my editor at Green Writers, and she said, "Hey, why don't you put them in there?" I said, "Well, Jesus, I don't know, man. I just having some fun with this stuff. It's crazy."
They're really fun.
Oh yeah, I had so much fun doing them.
They're very jazzy too.
Yeah. Oh, I had so much fun with them. This book has been a lot of fun. Yeah. All I can tell you is I've never had so much fun in my life.
Oh, that's great.
As playing with these poems and then writing about gigs and then making up stuff, creating different characters that weren't me, that were maybe wish fulfillment things, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how it went.
I wondered about your characters. I've got a bunch of questions about the stories that run through these poems. But I wonder...
I'd love to hear.
Now that you're living in the South, I wonder if you could sort of... first selection for us, read I Love Living in the South.
I love living in the South. If you're not going to do anything about it, get your nose out of all that mess, my mother used to say. With that thought in mind, I'm out of the house and down two blocks to B&J's for breakfast. I like to watch the locals heap on the grits and bacon, to hear the help singing from the kitchen. No sleep last night, I hear an old white lady say, and when I do, I dream of the devil. My mother would call this a privileged spiritual moment. I love the South like she does with all its appendages. There's so many churches, even the car washes and gas stations have churchy names. Jeremiah's Redeemed Auto Cleansing, Divine Justice Oil and Lube, and so on. But to call that lady's joke spiritual is like saying all the suffering of our world is heaven sent. I watch the customers come and go. I dig into the fatty portions as a man's pain-filled voice rises in the kitchen. Man, that is hot. And out again into the weather, I breathe in the low octane stink. I head down to the river. A couple of kids are whooping it up under the viaduct, pelican lights on a piling and is lost in reverie. At my age, I need to pay attention to weather, weeds and wildflowers on the riverbank. A poem I threw away days ago that was beyond saving. Tufts of coastal cloud promise a day of rain. The Greeks call this ecstasis, to stand outside yourself and watch the demon whirl pass by.
Thank you for reading that. I love that poem.
Thank you.
Did you grow up in the South?
No, I didn't. But I had a lot of connections. I have connections to it. My mother's from New Orleans.
Okay.
And, this town that we're in, this is a little funky town called Darien on a river here, big river draining a lot of eastern Georgia, reminds me of Bayou Country.
Yeah.
Lots of ways that I always, I enjoyed going to and visited as a kid a few times. And but my connection to here is in the 60s, I taught at a place called Morehouse College.
Mm-hmm.
It's a black university. In Atlanta, Martin Luther King was an alumnus of there, and it was a very powerful time. It was involved in civil rights, and one of my students came from this area, from the islands, and there are a whole bunch of islands here. And they're called Gichee Gullah people.
Okay.
And they trace themselves back pretty close to their African roots and have some African patterns to their language. So I just was fascinated with the area, and I sort of felt like there was something that was incomplete about my life that I had to complete by coming down here. And who knows what it is, but I'm having a great time.
Now, one thing that I loved in this poem that you just read, I Love Living in the South, is this: there's this subtle connection. The old white lady says, when I do, I dream of the devil. And then at the very end, you've got the demon world passing by. And I love that. I love it when a poem will make just a very subtle thread between ideas to kind of tie itself together. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Wow. I hadn't even thought of that.
You hadn't?
A lot of times, not really, but it's great that you brought it up. And, you know, to think that anybody would read your poem that carefully makes you feel blessed, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, well, I think to a certain extent, a lot of these poems have that feeling to them. And it goes through a lot of them.
Yeah.
The feeling that, you know, there's a lot of evil out there, but, you know, ride it, you know?
Yeah.
And step away from it.
Yeah.
It gives you this ecstasis, which gives you a moment of reprieve.
Right.
You know, even if it's just for a moment, you know,
yeah.
Kind of like Sisyphus going up the mountain, and before he has to go down again, he takes a deep breath and looks out over the landscape. He says, wow, then he's got to go and do it again.
So when there are those sort of subtle connections inside of a poem, do you think at their best poems are doing that without your necessary purposeful imposition of ideas and images?
Yeah. Yes, of course. But, you know, things are going on unconsciously.
Right.
That we have no idea about. And And I guess that, you know, that it was imbued in the poem from the beginning, right?
Right.
If, you know, if you don't, your mother's correcting you about how to live an upright, straightforward life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't mess around. So there's a kind of, and then, you know, there's also the theme of Southern religion.
Yes.
Goes in the poem. But, which I don't have much part of and don't want much part of.
Yeah.
So that's there.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned a poem I threw away days ago that was beyond saving, and that made me wonder, for writers who are listening, how much of your work do you end up throwing away or having to kind of start all over?
Not enough. yeah, I mean, I don't know if I throw away stuff so much as I just work it until I can see it. I tend to sometimes overwork stuff.
Okay.
I'll linger over something, and when I do that, I'm in trouble. You know, I got stuck in a poem this fall that took me about 6 weeks to work on, and which I think is actually healthy. Sometimes to get stuck is an important thing to happen because you have to sort of search your resources and think, why am I doing this?
Right.
Maybe I need to break away from a particular obsession that sometimes just wears you out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, but there are certainly things that I should have thrown away that I haven't. But mostly. My problem is that when I know it sucks, I can't let it go anyway, and so that's a problem for me. I have to make sure that I let it go and go on.
Right, right. Well, speaking of going on, you want to read another one?
Sure.
I was going to ask you to read "Time Remembered" on page 24.
You know, I don't know. Do you know Bill Evans' piano playing at all?
I do. I love Bill Evans. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely.
And do you know this particular tune? And I often listen to music when I'm writing, but I use it as a stimulus and then I turn it off.
Yeah.
You know, like I sit down, usually work about 3 or 4 hours, and maybe the first hour I'll listen to music and I shut it off.
Yeah.
So this is listening to this, and this poem connects up with others I'll talk about in a minute.
Okay.
"Time Remembered" after Bill Evans. It rained that night, and I watched moths, mammoth-sized moths, hovering about the glowing street lamp, moths pregnant with streetlight and rain. And I turned off the ceiling fan and heard her singing. And it came to me that our lives together had come and gone without me hearing her sing like that. Gone was gone. Spring, with all its attendant and inescapable suffering, was a prelude to the ruckus I heard beyond the screen. But she still sang, her voice altered by time and distance. I like to say I heard nothing, just those moths slamming their fleshy wings against the lamplight. But each note rose pitch perfect out of her like never before. I went outside in the yard and heard a block or two away, late night traffic on the throughway, and still she was there, singing her brains out. I headed down the driveway, besotted by the damp night air. The ash and cinder of winter had blown away. Angry little clouds were ready drop a mother load of rain on me.
Wonderful. I love him. I love his recordings with, doesn't he have recordings with Stan Getz as well?
Yeah, he did a lot. He did quite a bit with Stan Getz. He did a beautiful tune called "The Peacocks," and that's the poem I have in here, actually.
Oh, wow.
"The Peacocks." He did that. He did it with Stan Getz, but he also did it by himself. And if you want to hear something that's just absolutely gorgeous, it's up there with Chopin. I'm serious. It's a "The Peacocks."
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I love him. I wish there were more of his recordings. I feel like there aren't quite enough because he didn't live.
Never are.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he had little space and time when he just wrote. He did gorgeous things.
Yeah.
And then at the end of his life, he kind of just sped up too much. He went from the kinds of drugs that slow you down to the kind of drugs that speed you up.
Yeah.
And things didn't go not well for him, I don't think. But
yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, that first, say, 12 years from 59 or 58 to, say, 70, 72, just gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I wonder, in looking at "Time Remembered," your poem, can you talk a little bit about story in poetry, infusing your poetry with story, whether or not a reader will fully understand it?
Right. It's a sort of buried narrative, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
That's what those people call it. Yeah, well, in a way, this was a coda, you know, but a coda, C-O-D-A.
Yeah.
A or a footnote, a coda on, you know, or an appendix, or whatever, on the longer poem about my sister.
Okay.
Called Gallery, which is about, it's a long one, it's not too long to read aloud, I think.
Right.
But that's about my sister's death. And she was a singer,
yeah,
an opera singer. But there was also infused with just some sort of romantic something that really never happened in my life, or if it happened in my life, it wasn't that way, you know?
Right.
It's just, you know, sometimes you just sort of summon up a moment and think about hearing somebody's voice and it's gone and you're trying to recapture it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all that was in my mind, really. You know, then I saw, yeah, this connects with my sister after I finished it.
Yeah.
It was trying to remember her voice, her singing, who she was in that moment.
Writing about the personal stuff, is that hard, or do you find the poetry helps you deal with it?
Oh, yeah, interesting. I have a whole book of essays that are looking for a publisher now that are personal essays.
Yeah.
You know, autobiographical.
Sure.
And they're memoir, you would call them, they call it now.
Mm-hmm.
And they all deal with that directly.
Okay.
These poems, what was wonderful, what was fun about this was I felt like I was liberated from the self.
Mm.
That a lot of these, there are a few poems here that are me, you know, like Memory Train, about growing up and being a child of parents that were artists in Greenwich Village. And then some of these travel poems, and these are all places that I've lived.
Right.
And worked in. But they're more places that are stimulated by the location rather than anything that ever happened to me there. You know, a couple of them are really autobiographical. You
yeah.
know, I got sober about 26 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so I used to write a lot of, you know, what you call them, drunkalogue poems. They call that an AA drunkalogue. So you tell a long story about your sobriety.
Right.
And so a couple of these are sort of parodies on that, but not much.
I liked it.
That was what was so much fun about this, was not being burdened by the self.
And there was, I think I have a question about this later, so I won't go there now, but there is a poem later that I'm going to ask you to read that has to do with sobriety that I really loved. How about, would you mind reading Flying Low on page 29?
Oh, yeah. Flying Low. Yeah. Flying Low. In Flying Low, Abby Lincoln manages a series of half-steps, quavering between pain and pleasure, as a violin, barely loud enough, follows her, the words sung so it hurts to know she means them, and Stan, yes, a year or so from dying, plays a chorus longer than he needs to. He might have gone on forever. And then Lincoln's voice soars so perfectly, just a hairbreadth out of tune, you know the song, so dark it drags with it. Slipstream of desire is not about Japan, where she's written it, or about Miles, who may or may not have inspired its lofty darkness, or about how Lincoln exits the tune with only the bass, those first, final, slow 8 measures, and then the piano softly behind her. Nor is it about how in Kyoto, the temples at 4 a.m. burnish in the half light as Lincoln's taxi drives by, and a patch road monk looks up lonely from his sweep.
That's so wonderful. I love that poem so much. One of the things I really enjoyed about this collection altogether, Tony, is the way that you write about music. I wrote a novel that was published in 2014, and it has a musical undercurrent running through it.
And
it's hard to write about music, and I wondered if you can talk a little bit about it.
God, I want to ask you about your novel, but it's my interview. Oh, wow. Well, this particular thing, you know, what I was trying to do was extend a phrase.
Yeah.
So it's one long sentence, pretty much.
Right.
And it just keeps on going. Like, Getz will take a phrase into this sort of liquidy way he has of just carrying it and carrying it, and it just doesn't seem like it's ever going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles does the same thing. By the way, I tried in this collection, for the most part, not to have famous musicians involved in the poems.
Okay.
And this is maybe this and another one I mentioned Miles a couple of times. you know, Bud Powell, just occasionally because they happen to be part of the story.
Right.
But I didn't want to have a book. I really didn't want to have a book that was all about, you know, Bird and all these, you know, iconic figures that sort of dominate the poem and I think kill the poem.
Oh.
I was interested in, interested in real people.
Yeah.
How they go and round things and fail. But anyway, this is based on vaguely on a story that that I vaguely remember right now. And so it was situational.
Okay.
There was a gig in that particular tune, which isn't Flying Low, and I can't remember the name of the tune now, was recorded there. And Miles was, I believe, was said to be having an affair with Abby Lincoln. And how, and it was kind of a nexus of things happening.
Yeah.
Getz was only a year away from dying of pancreatic cancer. And so all these things kind of connect together.
Right.
But I also, it was also about how half steps, quavering between pain and pleasure, and things are just barely out of tune. So everything's just sort of quavering on the edge of imperfection.
Yeah.
That I wanted to get in the poem.
Yeah. I think one of the things that makes the music come through also is the very specific and gritty details of life that you include in your poems. And so in this one, for example, you're talking about all the things that are not her inspiration, but in a way they give us an insight into what might have been her inspiration. So like those temples at 4 a.m. burnishing in the half light. And I think that gives us so much to soak in and think about what this music might be sounding like. I don't know. I thought that was really great.
Yeah. Thank you. And it comes in at the end. We don't know where we are. Until we can gradually at the end of that first paragraph.
Right.
I spent 2 hours in Kyoto. I was on a flight. I taught in China for 9 months and then went back and actually did an anthology of contemporary Chinese writing. And the plane caught on fire on the way to China, believe it or not.
Oh, my God.
And landed, an emergency landing in Kyoto. We looked out the wind at the wing and there was flames coming out.
Oh, my God.
And so we. So I spent the night in Kyoto in this little tiny bamboo hotel room and then walked around. And, you know, I've always been interested in meditation and Buddhism, and that was what I saw.
Hmm. You're listening to Write the Book and an interview with the poet Tony Whedon, whose new poetry collection is The Hat Check Girl, published by Green Writers Press in partnership with Sundog Poetry Center. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you'd go to iTunes and rate it, review it, or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thanks and keep listening. Oh, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about organizing this collection. There are four sections of poems, and I'm wondering,
right.
How did you decide to do this particular organization?
I'm having fun in the first few poems, except when I get down to my sister's thing about gallery. You know, I love living in the South, and bam, you get hit, right?
Right.
In the first section. So, you know, it's kind of goofing around about the tradition of the new, and my cousin Josh Whedon in Malibu, and making fun of him and listen to the coyotes, you know. And so
that was a good one.
Most of those in the first section, they are kind of, you know, funky and having fun.
Yeah.
And it gets progressively darker as you go along, you know.
Yes.
And a little bit, not so much darker as it is crazier, you know, crazier until we get to Our Lady at Our Lady of Perpetual Snow. There are two characters in here. There's a character in here who is... See, the title poem is Hat Check Girl.
Right, yeah.
And it's the main character here is not me. This guy that plays the trombone who picks up this hat check girl and is driving around Quebec trying to get back in the United States, and he can't do that.
Right.
And so he kind of reappears in four or five poems. And finally,
as does she.
At the end, he and the hat check girl.
Right.
And I was a little bit concerned about this collection because of might have been read as sexist, and so I was aware of that with him and this you know, woman who's just identified as a, what she does for a living rather than as a human being.
Right.
And it always bothered me a little bit, but I never really corrected that, I don't think. But it does get crazier at the end in Our Lady and Perpetual Snow. Sort of brings in a lot of the themes of religiosity, sexuality, and being completely lost in I guess you could call it Hades,
Right.
Whatever.
And that's a real church, isn't it, in Stowe? Is there a church in Stowe called that?
No, you know this is based on?
What?
It's based on you want to go to a beautiful abbey. And I go up there quite a bit just to listen to the music. It's in Magog, Lake Lemfra Magog, right?
Okay.
You go up in Canada, and it's the town of Magog. And before you get to Magog, there is a Benedictine monastery.
Oh, yeah, they make cheese.
Have you been there?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and at 5 o'clock every afternoon, all these old monks hobble in on crutches and stuff and sit down and just sing their butts off. It's amazing music.
Oh, wow.
And there's an organist that plays. Yeah, the organist that plays there is considered one of the great world-class experts on Bach.
Oh, wow.
And, so it's... I thought of that place, and I know that also, I know AA people that go there for, like, hermitages, and
right.
Just to, meditate and stuff. And so I kind of just conceived of this place as a place that my favorite characters would go,
Right. Okay. Yeah, I have to say I loved that the title of the book comes from the interior of these poems that are following the story that you just mentioned, and that there is
right.
no story, there is no poem titled The Hat Check Girl. I loved that we
right.
kind of have to look for her as we're reading along,
right.
and that was great, and I enjoyed sort of following that story through the collection.
Well, she's sort of his guide, She's sort of his Beatrice,
Yeah.
So that's kind of part of it.
Do you want to read... Dreamsville, which is on 37, which is, I think, where she's introduced.
These poems are based on a friend of mine. There's a guy here that is maybe a combination of me and him.
Okay.
But his name is Barry Reese. Have you ever heard of Barry Reese?
No.
He lived in Vermont for a long time. Barry's one of the great living trumpet players.
Okay.
And he's played with Jerry Mulligan.
Okay.
He was Horace Silver's last trumpet player.
Wow.
He's played with almost all the big bands. He lived in Vermont for 5 years. We became very good friends and played together for about 5 years. And we see each other all the time. He was up here a couple of weeks ago, up in Vermont a while back. So Barry is based on adventures I've heard from him, and, so that's part of it.
Okay.
Dreamsville. Unable to sleep, you sat on the balcony to watch the traffic. It was snowing. The city was brilliant and white. Then he wandered into the hotel bar, bought a pack of Canadian cigarettes, and chatted up the hat check girl who said she knew who he was. Montreal in midwinter, and the weather outside was frightful, but his inner parts were working. The girl joined him for a drink at the bar, her little feet lost in oversized mucklucks, the fringe of her camisole revealing a half-inch scar where the cleavage began. He had a gig a few blocks down and asked her for another drink later, and she said she would. Soon he found himself alone in his hotel room. He lay in bed and blew into his mouthpiece, warming up. Snow spat through the balcony door. Night sifted around him. He dreamed about his ex, who the hat-check girl reminded him of, a dream that was still going on when he awoke, trailing him down the street to the club where three mirthless Frenchmen waited for him to screw up. Who knows where the soul goes if you die in a place like that? The common language was jazz, but these men weren't playing it. Jingle of Canadian coins, smear of lipstick on his cheek. He heard and felt all that as he played his first notes. The crowd unexpectedly cheered as he lurched into a second chorus of a tune he'd not heard before. The pianist smirked like a buzzard. The drummer smashed his foot cymbal, and he had no choice but to blunder on. Then the hat check girl wandered in. She loosened her hay-colored hair, and the notes kept coming. He found his stride and lost him. He liked what the bass player was doing frantic runs above block piano chords, changing key a moment with space enough for time to elude him. Later, as he plunged his grim face into her décolleté, she said, as in broken English, she liked the way he played that horn. It was really phallic. She lay beside him, draped across the street, until early next morning, the rap at the hotel door awoke them from dreamless slumber.
Thank you very much for reading that. It's a bit of a long one to try to read. I'm sorry about that, but I liked it.
No, I just kind of gasped over it because I hadn't ever read it aloud. I played actually a gig with Barry in Montreal. It wasn't a gig. I went up and played with him at a place called Upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Lovano was there. And
It
was quite a night.
Wow.
And it was one of the peak experiences, you know, one has.
Absolutely.
And it was just, it caught the mood of Montreal that night.
Now, I loved that the artwork. So a lot of these poems have corresponding artwork on the facing page, and most of them are very colorful. But this one is sort of black and white, or maybe it has a little touch of blue. And I wondered why, and if you could just is there a reason why?
You know what happened? I took one of my paintings and I put it on the scanner, and I got black and white out of it.
Uh huh.
I said, man, this is great. It sort of interrupts the colorful flow, right?
Yeah.
And it's basically, it was a colored painting. And I just sort of thought, this is actually got strong. It's stronger and more kind of, what you would say, Franz Kleinsish or something about it with without the color in it. And
yeah.
So that's why I did it.
I wondered if it had anything to do with dreams and you know, the controversy about whether we dream in color, but I guess not.
actually, it just seemed like a fit. I juggle these things around quite a bit on purpose, you know,
right,
to do this. Now, this book has a flaw, and I don't know if you noticed it, but I'll point it out to the reader. The flaw is the painting on page 13.
Yeah.
Is repeated later in the book.
Oh.
I don't know if you noticed that.
I didn't
notice.
But
it's something, and my editors didn't notice it either, and I didn't notice it. And I have another page which is I really like. It's coming out in the next iteration of this book when they run out of the copies that I already have. Yeah,
so,
that was really a disappointment. So I thought maybe nobody will notice.
So they just accidentally printed one of them twice and left out one of them.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. Right. They left out one. But I like some of the paintings, for example, on Dea, on page 53.
Yeah.
That picture is really, that was done purposely to juxtapose. That's supposed to be Circe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wonder if I can put a copy of that into the blog that goes along with the podcast site.
Maybe. Copy of that painting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you mind if I did that?
I would love it.
Okay. Okay, great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, since we brought it up during the interview. Because it's hard on the radio. People can't see what we're talking about, so.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, folks.
Yeah, no, it would be good if they could see that. So what is the medium? It's watercolor?
Watercolor, yeah.
And then some of them look like they have hints of other work behind the work, like notes or phone numbers. I can't quite tell.
I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
I just like the idea of scumbling, you know?
Right.
And taking some of them have two media, too, right?
Right.
So they'll be, I'll paint it, and then I'll draw over it. I'll draw first, and I'll paint over it, or I'll do both back and forth. The one with the number on it, that's on page... Yeah, that's my friend Tom Fay's number. He's a great piano player. He's a terrific piano. By the way, on my website, if anybody's interested, I've got a tune. I read I consider it the signature poem of the collection called Border Crossing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's with the hatchet girl and the protagonist are trying to get back into the United States and can't. So anyway, on my website, I read that poem with Tom Fay playing piano behind me.
Oh, cool.
Tom is an amazing piano player. Tom played with Barry Reese. the trumpet player I mentioned, for many years with the Mulligan Band. Tom and I grew up together, and we cut our musical teeth together as teenagers. And now he's, you know, he became a pretty well-known pianist and Broadway arranger and stuff like that. Made his fortune directing Broadway plays.
Right.
And now he's just retired and playing music.
Great.
So we did that together.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Now, I did want to ask you a little bit about your titles and how you go about finding titles for your poems. There's one, I won't ask you to read it, but you have this fantastic title, "While Fishing on Cathead Creek, a Woman's Face Floats Up from the Weeds and Accuses Me." It's like this awesome title. So,
God help us.
How do you go?
I wrote that poem. That's an old poem.
Oh, yeah.
That poem was published in a funky little magazine called, I can't even remember, it's on the, in my credits. But anyway, it was, I must have written that poem at Vermont College in the 80s.
That's a great title. So how do you go about finding your titles? What do you do? Do you have any advice for titling stuff?
That's a good question. You just have to goof around, you know?
Yeah.
You have to have fun. Sometimes they're real serious and they've got to be, you know, like Devil Thews Blues on page 40. That's just, you know, I wanted to keep that also the sense of it being musical.
Right.
And this is a kind of horrifying moment, which actually did happen to me when I was in Havana. The explosion didn't happen, but it's worth reading the poem, I mean, some other time.
Is it a very long poem? I'm trying to remember it.
A page long.
Why don't you go ahead and read it? What page is that on?
Okay, it's a pretty terrifying poem, and I'll try to explain the circumstances. Actually, Tom Fay and I tried to do a musical version of this, too.
Oh, here it is.
My Spanish isn't good, but I can say nice weather. I can tell a man and a kid like the devil and his son to leave the premises. And so when I let both in, I didn't see it coming. He heaved down in my landlady's nicest floral chair. And still, I didn't give him the money, but stood in the hallway another breathless minute, holding the potato, just 15 pesos. I'd throw in an onion, he said, and the kid's eyes drifted to the fly-buzzing ceiling. I watched the fireball burst from the old man's mouth, watched the curtains foul up, and the boy just laughed in Spanish as the room started to burn. Sweet potato, red Bermuda onion, the room blazing with his hungry laughter. More peddlers than hell knows about cruise the hallway. Nothing personal, they say, but I've seen their goofy stare. He was chubby, I remember, a little dizzy snoot of a beard, and the boy had a look that said, I've gone the limit, I know what's holy. You know us, the boy's eyes said, keep us out, don't forget to close the door.
Thank you for reading that.
No, I had fun with this. I mean, actually, that, you know, I was living in I was on a sabbatical in Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's pretty lonely. I mean, people would come up there, so, they were so poor. It was in 1994, I think. People would just beg, you know, just selling an onion or a piece of a potato or something like that. And it just killed you to see their poverty.
Yeah.
You know, that was after the Soviets left Cuba abruptly, you know, because the end of the Soviet Empire, and they were left on their own resources, and it was, I'd never seen anything like that. Everybody was really, really skinny and emaciated. It was quite something to experience that, you know.
Yeah. Now, you co-founded the Green Mountains Review with Neil Shepard. He's been on the show also. So, I wonder if you can offer a little advice to listeners who are writers for submitting work to journals. I'm sure you've done a lot of reading of submissions.
Yeah, and sent out a lot, too.
Yeah.
Mostly from my own experience of sending stuff out, I can tell you. Well, I think a lot of people say they need to go up the ladder, start a kind of lesser-known magazine, but I would say probably shoot for a really good magazine right off. If you don't think your worth is worthy of being in the great magazine, don't send it out.
Okay.
You know?
To anybody.
So many people. Yeah, I mean, really. You meet people who've written 3 or 4 stories, you know, have a small repertoire of work, and they immediately want to go out, and it becomes really sad because they've got one thing out, and they're going to the mailbox every day to see what happened to that. Did it get rejected?
Right.
And Don't you think it takes a while? You got to build up a mass of work, and also get to the point where you think your work is worth sending.
Yeah,
you know, the best of, and that's advice that Rilke gave to a young poet. You know, in his letters to a young poet, that's one of the things he said. Is, you know, you got to be sure that really this is really what you want to do too.
Right.
So that's a good thing. And then I, of course, multiple submit, you know, and stuff like that. I think people probably know all that stuff.
Do you avoid the journals that don't allow multiple submissions? There still are a few.
Oh, I just send them to them anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens? Well, you know, what happens if Harper's and the New Yorker accept both the same work at the same time? My goodness, I'm in real trouble. I mean, my God, you know, what am I going to do about that?
There you go.
No, I don't think, and it's never happened. It just happened to me a couple of times.
Yeah.
You know. A funny thing happened to me once. I had a piece, a long essay accepted at Salmagundi, you know,
yeah.
The magazine at Swarthmore. I published some stuff there before. I published some poems, and I believe I published an essay there. Yeah, I published an essay on Joseph Brodsky there years ago. And I sent this essay out to them, and they accepted it. Really, really excited about it. And the person who I won't mention, who was editing that magazine at that point, asked me to wanted to do a reading at Johnson State College.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't have any money to do it. I said, no, we can't do it. And about 2 weeks later, he says, I've decided I don't want to take your story. It's terrible. Oh, I don't know why I accepted it in the first place.
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, it was just such a bald-faced trade, you know, that was going on.
That's
and
shocking.
I managed to publish it somewhere else. But,
wow.
Yeah, well, a lot of people get into this business that should be in business.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that deal with this as a business. And I don't know. I don't think of it that way, but do you?
No, certainly not. I mean,
do you send a lot of stuff? Do you send a lot of stuff out?
You know,
how do you do that?
Lately, I don't send a lot of stuff out because I've been working on novels. But when I was working more on stories, I would send stuff out all the time. And I think I was getting maybe 1 out of 15 accepted, which is not terrible, actually. But I mean,
That's strict.
You know, it's not a business decision to be a writer. No, I mean, I know some people are making lots of money at it, but God bless them.
Well, I think it doesn't hurt to have some business skills.
Sure.
You know, I mean, just to be organized. And you know, it bothers me also when I see people who have done really good work and they don't follow to completion.
Right.
And you know, so much of this has to do with just working through and doing all the what used to be stamp licking now. You know, it's a different thing.
Yeah, the internet's made it all so much easier, but I'm sure that means that there are a lot more submissions being sent, too.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's just such, and I haven't been working at GMR for a good 10 years, so I'm not sure what's going on with that. But I just feel like you need to have a body of work, and you have to also get to know a publisher. It doesn't hurt to have a somewhat intimate relationship with the place you're sending things out to. And that takes a while, you know,
right?
4 or 5 years for a person to read your work and send something back, and then you get a conversation going and all that. So.
Yeah. Tony, I thought we would finish up the conversation with you reading one more poem. Do you want to pick one that I haven't chosen yet?
Yeah. I'm going to read a poem that... It's inspired by the great pianist Phineas Newmorn, who pronounced he wanted people to pronounce it Phineas, Phineas.
Yeah.
If people want to hear his music. He plays a very complex player. He was mentally ill. When he went into the hospital, a lot of times he tried to actually destroy his hands.
Oh yeah.
And so that was sort of part of the story. But it's just worth looking at his bio and not knowing too much about it when you hear the poem. And I've taken a phrase from a song called You Are Too Beautiful. It's called,
mm-hmm.
it but the name of the poem is Nocturne for Two Hands. And the quote, the little italicized quote is, I'm a fool for beauty. I've been listening to Finest Newborn, darkest of jazz pianists, listening to his blockbuster hands descend in octaves that nearly put him back in the madhouse, where what he recalled was a blue streak of noise that turned time into a slow-running stick so thick with petrochemicals it burbled its own toxic music. Newborn playing black coffee, filling my house with peace-shattering diatonics, his fingers faster than Tatum's, his soul blacker than Strayhorn. The music stopped and a chill came into the room. I played the CD again, turning it up loud. What happened to Finest Newborn? He had the same nervous breakdown over and over till he got it right. He kept smashing his hands to reach past the beauty that dogged him all his life.
Thank you for reading that. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I read that poem in preparation for our interview, I wondered if he was hurting himself, but I didn't know the history. When you said smashing his hands, it sounded more violent than just playing piano.
Right, but on the other hand, you know, there's a connection between all that pain and that beauty. And I think that runs through the book, if I would find a theme, you know, like that you see that I love living in the South, that sort of pain with this beauty connected with it throughout.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, it's sort of hard to extricate one from the other.
Yes, that's true. I want to mention again, the name of the book is The Hat Check Girl, published by Green Writers Press. Tony Whedon is the author. Tony, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was really a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Sheila.
That again was a conversation with Tony Whedon. You can learn more about his work at his website, tonywhedon.com. This week we have two Write the Book prompts, both suggested by my guest, Tony Whedon. First, either imagine an attic or remember one from your past and describe the things that you see there. Second, find a piece of music that you don't know that well and listen to it. Explore it with your own words as you listen. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.